States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, changes to today's agenda, please.
Amended item to closed session, one pending litigation. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session concerning the following items: B, conference with legal counsel, existing litigation, 12 people of the state of California versus Sani et al., and 13 people of the state of California versus Welsh et al. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Thank you very much. That brings us to our consent agenda. I do have one request to speak. Are there any other requests to speak on consent? Seeing none, I would also ask that you turn in speaker slips for public comment on items not on the agenda, which is the next item, and we will go with those slips that we have on the dais when general public comment opens. With that, Dr. Height on consent, please.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. And I see on the consent agenda you have item 4, District Attorney items, request to approve a renewal grant agreement to receive funding from State Workers' Compensation Insurance Fraud Prosecution and Investigation Program in the amount of $62,254 and submittal of a resolution authorizing the District Attorney to sign the state agreement and other grant-related documents, followed by 3 mental health support items, financial items. So just a history reality check here. I want to remind everybody how do we put this in terms, what a mess it was when the district attorney put, at first it appeared in the paper that the county was, district attorney was going to start prosecuting workman's comp fraud cases. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, this little notation there. And then things just went really, really bad, which significantly exposed the county. There were big exposés in the newspaper about what went so terribly wrong, who the county chose to pay as basically an informant, as he went after people, videotaped them at their wedding. Anyone who answers the question, can you or can you not lift this or do this, never, that's a loaded question, never when they're suffering from a temporary or permanent disability should answer that question, yes or no. It is a trick question. The answer is not without an unreasonable amount of stress, physical or emotional or mental stress, and that is in the DSS Manual of Policy and Procedures. So on these social items, which are mental health items, you're going to offer support. Number 9, San Luis Obispo Child Prevention Council. And I can tell you the very best way to not create mental suffering in the county, the best way to support counties, the best way to not contribute to the frustration that can lead to child abuse and the despair, the best way is to provide supportive services to your families. And I want you to think about something, because I want you to think about how embittered and what low self-esteem children are going to have when they see their mother stressed out fighting for the food stamps that they are eligible for, but in the past the county just didn't provide the food stamps and they almost lost their food stamp grant. I want you to think of the despair of the children seeing their parent humiliated, going through rigmarole and red tape that should not be placed. This is creating mental illness. It's mental suffering. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Height. With no other requests to speak, we'll close it to public comment on consent and bring it back to my colleagues for items to pull. Supervisor Arnold? Mr. Meacham?
None, sir.
And Mr. Hill?
None, sir.
Nor do I. With that, I would entertain a motion.
Move approval of the consent calendar.
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham and Mr. Hill. And a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. With that, we do come to public comment items not on the agenda. I have 7 requests to speak that we will go with. We'll begin with Julie Tacker, followed by Dr. C. Height.
Good morning. I'm Julie Tacker. I live in District 2 and in Los Osos. And today I'd like to speak a little bit about the wastewater project. A few hundred of us subscribe to the diglososos.com website. And last night we got a blast eBay National Estuary. The National Estuary Executive Committee met last week, and Mr. Gibson was there and characterized the letter that I presented you last week from the Regional Water Quality Control Board as a misunderstanding. Whose misunderstanding? Is the Regional Board misunderstanding that this is the approach that the county is going to take? Or is the county misunderstanding the requirements of the permit and the requirements to test the water and that it must meet a certain criteria before it is dumped to land or to the bay? Who is misunderstanding the Regional Water Quality Control Board? When we talk about the more difficult parts of town, those cannot be dug in when it's raining. You in Paso Robles are doing rain dances right now. It's going to rain during the construction of the Los Osos Wastewater Project. And when it rains and you're trying to build the treatment facility in the clay, that soil will turn to liquid cement and your tractors will be stuck until the ground dries out. So we are nowhere near the schedule in which we should be when we have a construction schedule that's built on balance. And who approved the construction schedule? HDR, the construction management firm, and your project manager, who really has no experience building anything.
Dr. Height, followed by Richard Margetson.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop. And I guess scandalous is the word I'm looking for. Following up on last week's public record request, dear Senator Feinstein, on the issue of nuclear safety in San Luis Obispo County, encloses a copy of my public records request sent by email with hard copy presented following my public comment speech at the San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors on August 13, 2013. I am awaiting a response from the county. I will remind you that Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant is on the Central Coast near populated areas and now has above-ground storage of nuclear waste. Attached is a video link of my 8/13/13 public comment, including how the new chairman of the board, following the untimely death of Chair Paul Teixeira, chose the moment I was called to speak to inflame an argument over the public's right to speak. Link enclosed. And it begins just like your public record request about the code and so on. The requester does request within 10 business days, the County of San Luis Obispo does provide any tangible evidence, memo, or email that shows District 2 Supervisor did responsibly address issues of evacuation of Emergency Planning Zone 5, Los Osos, during the ongoing construction of the Los Osos Wastewater Project, and so on. And I continue to Senator Feinstein. Since this 8/13/13 public records request was made, the national news media has carried reports about nuclear safety. And there's two links, including the Minot, North Dakota scandal. In addition, we have local siren tests scheduled for Saturday, August 25th, which will be announced for the first time via the reverse 911 system. And there's links. The subject of concern is not only timely, considering that at any given time, the senior disabled demographic of Los Osos Baywood Park have their evacuation routes blocked due to the construction of the controversial Los Osos Wastewater Project. Links. I point out to you that currently the County of San Luis Obispo website and Dig Los Osos website have not addressed the issue of evacuation of Emergency Planning Zone 5 during the Los Osos Wastewater Project. And there are six links. Hopefully my 8/13/13 public records request will prompt change. And I made a lot of web page saves because I imagine that even though you don't pay me to do a county job, I imagine that your websites are going to start rapidly changing. Now, I have a real issue. Next time you call me to speak, do not start a fight with the public.
Thank, Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Margetson, followed by Ben DeFada.
Richard Margetson. I want to first finish up on what I was talking about last week about the rates and charges for the wastewater project. This is the last time I'm going to bring this up. There's now complete evidence that the initial rates and charges are incorrect. And the reason this is, again, I'm going to state, is so important in Los Osos is the current ordinance has the residential component of that ordinance subsidizing the commercial component of this rates and charges ordinance. They have the ability to write this off. They have the ability to write off their sewer charges. The numbers were wrong back then. At least a dozen times I brought it to the county's attention, and nothing's been done about it. The rest of my time, I want to address, again, what happened last week. Mr. Gibson insists on not following the Brown Act when it comes to public comment. And Ms. Arnold, I appreciate you standing up for the public, not just me. I know you were talking about all the public that come to give public comment last week. Mr. Gibson saying, what if somebody got caught in traffic this morning and walked in right now and had driven from Cambria to give a public comment? They wouldn't be able to turn in a speaker slip? That's how the other two supervisors are going to handle this? Neither of you have spoken up and said that this is the wrong policy at this point. Mr. Gibson insists on this being the process. I think it's time to call California Aware. And Mr. Lindholm would have never in a million years let this proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Mr. DeFada, followed by Mike Brown.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, public. I am Ben DeFada from Los Osos, where soon many friends will have to leave their homes because of Mr. Gibson's mega-priced sewer project from hell and the water cost. The founders of this country, before they left this earth, left us with the greatest idea for a democracy, republic government in the world with their constitution for a United States. Many have come across the ocean to escape tyranny, dictatorship, slave labor, and most of all, freedom to do as they wish, to pursue their desires without interference from government, whether local, state, or Washington, D.C. All they wanted the new government to do was to protect the citizens from invasion by other countries and to protect us from our own government if it sought to take over and take away our freedom. And I think most of all was freedom of religion. This government was formed to protect the people and their rights under the newly formed Constitution, and the citizens was to tell the states to tell the government what was needed. Sure, there was a lot of compromising, but they got it right. Can you imagine a group of men that settled here from all different parts of Europe, sat down, drafted the new Constitution, and came up with this brilliant document called the Constitution, which states we the people and so forth, rights under God and so forth. Well, I guess I'll have to skip a little bit. Now we have, can't use the word God in schools, yet it's all right to teach little children trash, overturn many moral laws and so forth. City of Chicago, where Obama lived, over the 4th of July, there were 63 gang-related murders and many others wounded. Yet the president and the media can only concentrate on one shooting in Florida, saying it was racial because the shooter looked white. Now we hear that Detroit went bankrupt, and Saturday the news was that New York is near bankruptcy, and who knows when California will also be bankrupt. Now here in the North County and Los Osos, we see a water war coming about. These days, water is king and costs as much as gasoline. With increasing property taxes and the price of Mr. Gibson's overpriced and unaffordable sewer project, many now find themselves letting their landscaping die in order to survive. I will go to, I see that the county has one less conflict of interest employee when John Wallace leaves. And last week, Ms. Weir spoke about the homeless problem. I must tell her to be prepared for more homeless in another year. $2,000 to $3,000 a year increase on your property tax bill on top of the one's normal tax bill is a big hit for many. And if you remember, Rogue Pierre of Russia destroyed a whole country by bankruptcy, by bankrupting, starving, and murdering millions of people. Well, Mr. Gibson is destroying a whole town with his extra tax, overpriced, unaffordable, stinking sewer.
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta. Mr. Brown, followed by Lindy Owen.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. Next week, you have scheduled on the agenda the perhaps a vote on a moratorium in the Paso Water Basin. And this is, of course, a huge issue, maybe the biggest issue you've had in the last few years. And we would hope, given that the information that staff is developing gets posted as soon as possible. Typically, you post the coming week agenda late on Tuesday, which is good. It gives some time. And then the detail, which contains the information, comes at various times during the week, I would imagine, depending on the complexity and last-minute checking if it's okay. In this case, it would actually work. And is that too oppressive, and could it even violate the Kuntz Doctrine of the Supreme Court? And then does this really discriminate against ag because you don't have land use authority over the cities? And all these questions are in play. And then what is the exact imminent danger to people, that justifies a moratorium in the name of public health, safety, and welfare? So, you know, how many people's well is dry, and does the number of them significantly justify a finding of imminent danger? And there's a whole lot of court doctrine out there about jurisdictions doing these kinds of urgency ordinances in their land use, and they cover everything from water to massage parlors and everything else.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Owen, followed by our last request to speak, Eric Greening.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos, and I too object to trying to keep the public from having a chance to speak in front of our five supervisors, four currently. And then I also wanted to speak to something that was said previously to put it in a perspective. On the Los Osos wastewater project, one-third of the trenching is completed, but over 50% of the budget for that trenching is gone. So we've got a problem there. You heard earlier, 3 months ago, that one half of the paving budget was already spent, or it was 50% over. This project is starting to calculate up some new expenses, and you need to know what they are, and we need oversight because this should not be happening. We knew it would. What I'm showing you is pictures of our new, I don't know, Mr. Gibson can tell us maybe if it's a park, or if this is restoration, or if this is a collection basin. It's the middle of town site that was destroyed during the last project. To date, we've got about almost $800,000 spent on this, and we did, you know, trying to combine something like this has been what is ironically a comedy right now. This is the planting. As you can see, it's not going so well. We spent $60,000 having native seed collected and then planted all over. We have maintenance crews come out and pull the weeds, the veldt grass. Then the county decided to spend $60,000 to put a walkway through there, although on the restoration, this property never had one walkway through it, ever. But the county took it upon themselves to turn it into a pseudo-park, except now the plants are drowning. They're drought-tolerant, and they just don't know how to live in high groundwater. The very sad part about this is supposed to be a collection basin that Fugro consultants told us would hold 32 million gallons every day. Currently, it cannot hold 500,000. Now, the county wants to take our dewatering, which is from our upper basin, all the water that we have left for future use, and they want to put it into the bay. But they told us it would fit on this piece of property as well as Broderson. There's no place to put the water. And Mr. Gibson said he's going to work on the regional board to get them to allow it to be dumped in the bay. That's a serious problem, folks. Why do we spend the money with Fugro, which was quite a large amount, $380,000 to grade this like five times? This isn't going well, and there's no oversight, and I don't think the county is capable of being its own oversight. At this point, John Waddell has never built a sewer. He's been here in the county, has no outside experience. Mr. Ogren, I don't know where he comes from, but he's an accountant. He has no idea what this is. Please get us oversight.
Mr. Greening.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and my main item here relates to a deadline for comments on an environmental document. But first, I want to follow up on an issue Mr. Margetson raised. Normally, when you have an agenda item, after the staff report, you have an opportunity to ask questions. And I wonder how many of you know in advance whether you will have questions to ask. Obviously, all of us can read the written staff report, but often things come up in oral presentations that raise questions. And when they are raised, they need to be asked. If they're raised in any of our minds, they need to be asked. I'm wondering how fellow supervisors would feel if the only way they would have a right to ask a question during the hearing would be if they had submitted a slip to do so before the hearing began. Sometimes when one supervisor has questions relative to a staff presentation, the answer raises other seismic testing. There is now no time to agendize a collective response, but it still deserves individual responses from people who are willing to visit the State Lands Commission website and read the 400 and some page negative declaration or the parts that seem to be the most salient and the appendices that seem to be the most salient. And comments can be either snailed to an address that you can find there, and I won't take the time to read it, or E'd to capital CEQA, then lowercase comments at slc.ca.gov. And my understanding is if the email is issued by, you know, hit send by 4:59 on Friday, these will have to be dealt with. There will be a subsequent hearing on whether to certify this negative declaration. And I'll keep you posted on that as time advances. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. With that, we'll close general public comment. And before we go to our next item, let me ask Mr. Buckshy. We obviously do have a very big day next Tuesday. The only board item after consent and public comment is going to be our consideration of issues in the Paso Robles groundwater basin. When might we expect that the staff report on that item will be available on the website?
The target is later today.
Later today.
Okay. Certainly, you know, our overall goal is to have it on the weekly agenda published the Wednesday before. We usually try to exceed that and have it published the Tuesday, which is our target for this as well.
Very good. And we certainly do expect and welcome and encourage the public comment at the item that we're going to hear on the 27th. We would also encourage those interested in providing comments to deliver them to us in a written form. And the earlier that they can get into the hands of the supervisors and our clerk, the more time we have to make a thoughtful consideration of them. So, again, a number of different ways in which folks can get input into the public process. The oral testimony at the hearing item is one. But the written means, whether it be email, snail mail, or hand-delivered notes are certainly welcome as well. I would say when you do bring written materials at the day of the hearing, it would be appreciated if you would bring copies for each of the four supervisors and our staff on the dais, so a total of seven. The clerk certainly needs one for the record. So just a little bit of housekeeping on the matter of public input and the development of the record. With that, unless you had a comment, Ms. Arnold?
May I comment on the public comment? So we just saw a series of slides from Los Osos that sound was supposed to be restoration. Is that
That's the Midtown site, the site of the previous proposal for a treatment plant in the middle of town.
Right.
As a condition of the as a condition of the permit for the current project, the Coastal Commission required that the county restore that site to its native habitat, including the waterways, of which there are a number of drainages that course through it, and that the uses would be restricted to the passive recreation and basically passive enjoyment of that habitat. The Coastal Commission actually approved the plans for that restoration, including the fact that watering from the high groundwater area is going to be discharged onto that site. And so the water that you see there is water that's being transferred from trenches where groundwater is high. We are in communication with the regional board. At this point, there is no problem, but I'm going to be meeting with the regional board to be sure that we're proceeding and that the regional board understands that we're proceeding within the requirements of the permit that the regional board has issued us. So at that point, that's where we are.
And thank you for that. My question really is, I mean, we all start projects, and sometimes they go well and sometimes they don't. Is that the way it's supposed to look?
Yes.
Or are we having...
Yeah. Well, the vegetation on the Midtown site suffers from the fact that we had a very poor rain year. And so there is vegetation, natural vegetation in place there that has not done as well as it should have. It was put in late last fall as the project started with the hope that it was going to get some rain, and it didn't get anywhere close to it. So it is not where it is. I'm not sure exactly what funding we have or what requirement we have, but typically when we restore an area, we do have a requirement to make sure that the restoration gets to the point where it's going to be self-sustaining. So that'll be an ongoing item for our staff to keep track of. But at this point, the Coastal Commission is well aware of where we are on this project. And again, we'd like it to look better, but it just is.
Well, and that's really my question. My question is just, as a county, are we going to have to go back and kind of redo? Is this not ending like?
Office here, I'll offer a brief introduction to this item and then hand it over to your board for discussion. As a bit of background, we began contracting with the federal lobbyist, the Ferguson Group, in October of 2006, so a little less than 7 years ago. The issue came up this year during our budget hearings in June. As your board will recall, there is the $72,000 that was proposed to be included in the budget. Your board did ultimately approve that amount in the budget, but directed that staff come back with a discussion about whether or not we would want to continue the contract for the federal lobbyist, and that is why we are here today. The staff report does provide some information about what the Ferguson Group has worked on over the past few years, highlighting some of the results and some of the main activities that they've been involved with. I'm not going to run through those. I'd be happy to, you know, answer any questions about any of that information contained in the staff report. And with that, I'm available to help answer any questions that your board may have.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions for Mr. Buckshire? Seeing none, I will open it to the public. We have one request to speak, Mr. Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I noticed that most of what they deliver is money into the county for various sorts of projects, and so our expectations of them seem to be less than they are of the Peterson Group, where there is also considerable work on policy questions. And I would like to think that if they're getting paid like this, they should be able to engage in both, just as the Peterson Group is. There certainly are some major issues. I was just talking about seismic testing, and I note that as of now, the U.S. Navy is saying they will not comply with the conditions the Coastal Commission placed on them, for example. That's an interesting federal issue. I don't know where one would engage with it, or if it's at the congressional level. There have been, in a county that has such a rich cultural life, we might take interest in such things as the National Endowment for the Arts and the various kinds of posturing that has happened. Same thing with Amtrak. Both funding sources are threatened with evisceration at this time. a major issue. I've already raised concern about the drone zone and the decision out of San Diego and whether we're included in it. Right now, we have an even more urgent drone zone, even though we are not geographically in it. The discussion about the federal immigration reform, so-called, usually is simply a discussion about paths to citizenship and struggling people who want to become part of us, etc., etc., and it rarely looks at the reality of what's in the Senate bill and the talk of what might, if it moves at all, happen in the House. We are talking about a vast territory in the southern part of this country where the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution would not apply, and the drones and other government watching apparatus would be watching everything that moves 24/7. My fear is this test run for the total surveillance state, under whatever pretext, once it gets that test run, could be extended through the entire homeland. And I think we need to demand that in any immigration reform bill that totally ignores the Fourth Amendment be blocked, that there be no such bill this year, because it is treading on sacred ground. I realize that there are things happening at the border, and eyes and ears are helpful. But the overkill, the vast expenditure of funds, the vast amount of equipment, the 24/7 surveillance of everything that moves is inconsistent with the very Constitution that 11 million people say they want a path to citizenship to live under. And whole package is utterly unacceptable and needs to be blocked.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. With that, we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board for any further discussion. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
Please.
Just inattention on my part.
Obviously, I've been one that's questioned the funding for this over years, and I went back and I've looked at what they've been able to accomplish. And obviously, my question has been, if we, in fact, engage with the federal lobbyists, do they put us in touch with who, when, and how we're trying to get something established? Obviously, with the discussion that's going to come up next week, my emphasis right now and my highest priority is trying to figure out a project that would help sustain the water basin in the North County. And if, in fact, our federal lobbyists can help facilitate...
Hey, look, we want to know anything and everything that might be of use to this this very big issue for us. I think it'll be well worth the money spent. So I would join you in if part of it is, let's focus on anything and everything that might be of use to addressing the Paso groundwater basin.
Yeah, and speaking to Mr. Meacham's interest, I can tell you that our federal lobbyist is already working on that and making a very important contact within the Bureau of Reclamation. When I was on the trip to Washington in April, we sat with, you know, there are assistant deputy undersecretaries of this, that, and the other in Washington, part of the Byzantine structure that Mr. Hill references, but that the purpose of that meeting was to get Ms. Courtney Howard in touch with the folks within the Bureau so that they understood our approach and we start to understand theirs.
Well, what really piqued my, I guess, further interest in our relationship is when I asked them what could they provide in terms of programs that might find assistance for folks. And he sent me a very, very lengthy list of different agencies. Unfortunately, a lot of it doesn't directly relate to an emergency situation. We'll have to figure out ways we can deal with that, and I think we can. But again, what my focus is going to be on is it's time to seriously start talking about a project in which we can start stabilizing the basin. And he has outlined a number of agencies, as you mentioned, the Bureau of Reclamation, USDA, Corps of Army Engineers, that could assist us in, number one, a project, and number two, supplemental funding to help get that project accomplished.
So. Very good. So I'll entertain a motion unless you had
comments. I, too, was one that questioned, and for me it wasn't so much. I'm well aware of the good that lobbyists can do for an entity like our county. And Mr. Buckshire and I talked about that yesterday. Probably Sacramento is a little more important, like Mr. Greening pointed out, in policy and legislative issues, to know what's going on up there that directly affects us. So for me earlier when we were doing budget, to see that we were spending, and I thought it was $80,000, $72,000, right in there, dollars on a federal lobbyist, which came about, or you engaged the federal lobbyist just a few years ago, it's my understanding, to work on identifying grant money and help for the Los Osos project. I just questioned where the money was coming from. We were looking at many nonprofits that were actually doing work in our county, tangible work in our county, and we were taking money or denying them money and putting it into a pot to hire a federal lobbyist. And at that time, really with some unidentified needs. So that was my question then. The system in Washington, D.C. has changed over the last few years. Earmark money, we used to be able to ask, and our elected lobbyists were helpful in that system where were able to bring money, especially into your counties for particular projects. That system's changed a little bit. So what lobbyists, in my mind, provide us now, or their most important function at the federal level, is providing information to us. Like Supervisor Meacham just explained how helpful that's been for him in the last couple of weeks, and myself as well, and also identify the grant programs. But the money will be flowing not so much in the way of earmarks, but through grants and program monies. So anyway, my question still remains, or I'd like to at least have it reiterated in public session. How are we paying for this? With what are we giving up to be able to afford to buy a federal lobbyist?
The funding for the federal lobbyist comes from two buckets. Roughly half is paid for by Public Works because a big focus has been on Los Osos and other infrastructure activities. The other half is from the general fund. And something I should clarify, and I think it's something we're going to address in the upcoming fiscal year in the 14-15 budget, is that this funding does not necessarily directly compete with the bucket of funding that's set aside for the not-for-profits. It is contained in the same budget unit, if you will, but it was really a different division. And that has caused some confusion over the years. This isn't the first time this has come up. So I think to address that, we're going to segregate out the types of contracts, such as the Peterson contract, the Ferguson contract, our commitment that we have to pay towards LAFCO, the cost for our deferred compensation program, some of these other things that we have to pay for that don't have a natural department, if you will, to oversee those. We're going to put those into a separate fund center to make it a little cleaner for the future and clearer.
Okay. I appreciate that. And with that clarification, I will be able to support our contract.
Just finally, and just kind of to add to the discussion relative to what
to see if how this was going to play out. You know, obviously, PASA will play a key role in that, but we'll be updating the overall legislative platform. We'll bring that to your board in the not too distant future.
Ms. Arm?
How, if you're talking about a legislative platform, then besides an ask for things that we need, projects that we need help with, who's constructed the legislative platform? How's that been drawn up?
We solicit input from departments on areas that they're interested in, of policies or programs or regulations that may impact their operations. And in the past, we've brought that first draft to the board for input from the board and ultimately to be adopted by the board. So it's been an iterative process between staff and the board.
Okay. Does the board in the past, has the board weighed in on direction before it comes in front of us, or is that all done? The discussion is all done here in the board meeting?
You know, we can solicit individual input, but the main deliberation is in public with the board meeting.
Okay.
Yeah, and as a follow-up to that, we have an opportunity to hear from, like, the district attorney, from sheriff's office, public works, items that they feel are the most important to address from a legislative standpoint. So we do get to hear them privately in briefings, but then it's all vetted publicly in terms of the legislative platform.
And we have had a legislative platform as long as we have had federal representation. Mr. Mike Miller of the Ferguson Group does meet with us in, at least once or twice during the year to gather our pieces of interest and brings together a proposal that we then act on.
Thank you.
With that and no further discussion, Madam Clerk, a roll call, please.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. And if you would then be so kind as to introduce our next item.
Item number 14, presentation of a report on the economic contributions of agriculture in San Luis Obispo County.
Commissioner Sedevendemi.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Supervisors. My name is Marty Sedevendemi, Agricultural Commissioner, and today we're going to present an overview of the economic contributions of agriculture to San Luis Obispo County. And today, also presenting with me are Dr. Jeff Langholtz and Dr. Fernando DePaulis from Agricultural Impacts Associates, who helped us do this project, as well as Jackie Krapp, who is our Executive Director from the Farm Bureau. And just to go ahead and get started, Ryan, could you bring up the first slide, please? Just a little bit about the purpose of this study. We wanted to assess the economic significance of agriculture in San Luis Obispo, and there were a few aspects that we looked at. First of all, we looked at the overall crop production within the county, the overall value. We looked at the overall value of locally sourced food processing. And then we looked at employment, and then we applied the associated multiplier effects to get an overall view of the contributions of agriculture to our county. We wanted to go ahead and use this information to inform policymakers and community groups who may deliberate on issues related to agriculture. We wanted to provide information to agricultural-related businesses so they could assess their viability within our community. And we simply wanted to increase public awareness related to agriculture and agriculture's contributions to the county. And then lastly, we wanted to expand on our traditional crop reporting. Historically, we tend to just look at the overall production in the county, the associated acreages, and then the ultimate value of agriculture in the county. But we don't look at those secondary economic contributions that this report goes into. And while we can't do this type of report each year, we hope that we can at least do this every few years to keep the information fresh and keep that information available to the public. And then a little bit of the background on this study. My department has many very bright and talented individuals, but we're not economists. So we did have to go outside the department, and we hired Agricultural Impacts Associates, as I mentioned, Dr. Jeff Langholtz and Fernando DePaulis. We also solicited input from the Agricultural Liaison Advisory Board, and ALAB was instrumental in helping us scope the project and also helping us ground truth some of the local data that we used in the project so that our report was as accurate as possible. Of course, we had a lot of help from my staff, primarily Mark Lee, our Deputy Ag Commissioner, as well as Brenda Auerkirk, our Chief Deputy Ag Commissioner. And then in order to get this report off the ground, we had to utilize a complete data set, a complete year's worth of data set. And we started this project in 2012, so our last complete year was calendar year 2011. So all of the information in this report is based on that calendar year. And at that time, our overall agricultural value, our farm gate value, was $736 million. And additionally, in this study, we looked at employment, and there are 20,645 jobs that were attributable to agriculture in 2011. 15,619 of those were directly involved in agriculture, so about 1 in 10 employees in the county are working in an agriculturally related occupation. And then there were 5,027 jobs that were a result of multiplier effects. Another area that we looked at in this study has to do with the diversity of agriculture. And when we started this project, we had the opportunity to look at something unique about San Luis Obispo. We could have looked at a certain growing region and highlighted that, or we could have looked at a certain commodity type. But that, to me, seemed a little bit too focused. So we looked at an overarching aspect of our agriculture, and that's the diversity. And that's actually a good segue. I'm going to bring Jeff Langholz up to talk a little bit more on this aspect and talk a little bit more about the methodology of this study and explain a little bit more about the multiplier effects. And then after that, I'd like to ask Jackie Crabb to come up and say a few words on behalf of the Farm Bureau, and then we'll be happy to answer any questions that you have related to the report.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Langholz.
Okay. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and we're delighted to share the results of this analysis with you. On behalf of Dr. Fernando de Palos and myself, we'd like to talk about some of the study findings, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the methods. And we'll just show a few. We'll pop the hood here and take a look at a few things in particular. First of all, on crop production, you can see how we come up with the totals. The numbers in the bottom right talk about the total economic output on the production side, as well as the total employment. And you'll see a couple of columns there on the right, indirect and induced. Those are the multiplier effects. And I'll just explain how we come up with those numbers. Whenever an agriculture company buys fertilizer, equipment, banking services, insurance, anything else, that ag money circulates in the local economy, and we call those indirect economic effects. And then induced effects are when these companies and their employees in particular spend money in the local economy. If you work for an ag company and you take your kids to the doctor or go to movies or buy any kind of medical care, leisure, or anything like that, that money also circulates locally, and those are the induced effects. So you can see how we came up with these totals in the bottom right. Ryan, can we get the next one? And then, as Commissioner Sedevedmi said, we also looked at locally sourced value-added food processing. We just looked at the types of companies in the county that depend on local raw materials for their processing. And we added up the value of those, and you can see the categories we have here. And how much it adds up to, not just on economic output, but also on the employment side. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. DePaulis for the final slide in a moment. Let me just say one thing about the diversity. You'll find in the report that the diversity score for San Luis Obispo County agriculture is quite high compared to other counties in California. That's the good news. The not-so-good news is the diversity score does show a slight decline over the last decade. You're becoming more and more dependent on a smaller number of crops.
Dr. DePaulis.
Good morning. Thank you so much for inviting us. Could we go back to the previous two slides? As you can see in these two slides, we're not indicating any figures at the crop level. We're using larger aggregates as fruit farming and vegetables and tree nut farming. We're not making any specific reference to any particular crop, and that is sort of a idiosyncratic characteristics of the data that we have used. For the details of the value of output at the crop level, the crop report makes an excellent presentation of those figures. Also, there's no reference directly or indirectly to firms. We have not had access to any confidential information at the firm level. We only have analyzed industry-level figures. And the next one, please. So for the previous one with the production side of the field, and this slide shows the manufacturing side using locally sourced inputs. The next one shows the total, the combination of everything that we call the agriculture cluster in San Luis Obispo County. We have the
economy the 20,645 jobs provided, and then the business tax payments take up 10% of our county's budget, making us a leading industry. And there are 2 points coming from a layperson in reading this that got my attention. One is the mention of our agriculture as a basic industry, and that is that we export most of our products, but by doing that, we bring in outside money into our local community. And some years ago, I came across some statistical formulas to calculate how much acreage you need to be able to feed one person. And I took that those formulas and added it to the county statistics, and it, again, layperson, came up with 5 to 7-fold times we can feed our population. So you add that with the fact that we have a very vibrant farmers market and other sources of locally produced products being sold to our local community, we're on the right track. The other point that was stressed in this report is the diversity of our agriculture, and I went back to the 1920 crop report just for fun to see how we were doing back then, and we were very diverse in the products that we had then, but also over time we have this resiliency to change our products. So if you look back, you had the dairies, you had the sugar beets, you had sugar beets and sugar peas, I'm sorry, also those. And now today we've had this shift into, for various reasons, whether it be marketing, disease, or what have you, but we shift to such products as the wine, grape, strawberries, the olives, and the avocados. And so we continue to be a leading industry. And with that, we are pleased with this report, and we appreciate the efforts by the Ag Liaison Board and by the consulting firm, the Agricultural Impact Associates. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grab. Wrap up, Marty.
Thank you. I just hope that this information is important to all of you and also to the community, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
All right. Mr. Hill, I think, has a question, followed by Mr. Meacham.
And this would be for the economists on the methodology, and this just may be this is one area where I like to be a little wonkish. How is the data collected and evaluated? I mean, you mentioned that you know your calculations drew from local and national data sources, so I wonder if specifically you could mention how the data was collected and then evaluated.
Yes. We use a commercial product called Implan. It's an industry standard for analyzing local economies. It's a company that is an offshoot, if you will, out of the Forest Service and University of Minnesota, and they've been in business for 30 years or something like that, maybe a little more. And it's a widely accepted software and data package that allows you to analyze rather small geographic areas, and the center of their geography is the county. So we're very confident in certain aspects of that. By their own acceptance, certain dimensions of the agriculture, the specific of agriculture production makes the data collection very, very difficult. So we benchmarked their own data with our own estimates, including federal data, but also local experts. And that's where the commissioner's office and the ALAB provided probably impossible to substitute support.
And if I could, so the data that's provided locally, is it self-reported, or is it provided with any kind of material receipts, or I guess the question is how do you evaluate the data that you're getting, even if it's a sample, in order to extrapolate into?
We circulated our own estimates to a group of experts and collected their opinion, and in most cases it was unanimous that the number was very close to their own sense of the of that particular figure, either on output for a particular group of commodities or employment.
And I guess finally a question would be, are there other ways to make this analysis that and I'm not, you know, arguing with the analysis one way. I'm just interested, actually. I'm one of those people who reads these economic impact reports all the time for fun, which is
Mr. Hill.
I know I'm revealing way too much, but is there are there other ways that you could see that we might be able to get a more detailed and specific and confirmable way of narrowing down exactly how much we're seeing and maybe provide even a more firm baseline from one point to the future?
Sure. Absolutely. So we're probably looking at, you know, 6 or 7 people working for 2 years and a $2 million budget.
And does your firm have access to proprietary databases that would be of help if you know just to suggest, if we were to look at on any of our important industries, but this one being your specialty, are there other ones that
there are other commercial products in addition to implant? We decided to use this one because it was the most cost effective given the scope of the project and the budget. We decided to use implant. There are 2 or 3 other products that tend to be more expensive and not necessarily always more efficient.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meacham?
I almost could answer that question for him when you asked what would it take.
It's like a softball right there.
Well, this is more for the Ag Commissioner. I really appreciate this report. I mean, you know, I've been asking for some time, asking questions about the overall value of our Ag. You raised something, or one of the gentlemen did a moment ago, talking about the export that we do, or maybe it was Jackie that talks about our export. At some point, I'd really be interested to know, what do we import? What outside products that create part of our economy that we import into our area? I don't know what that would be, and we don't need to get into that right now.
Well, I could just...
But I think any type of an economic report, it generally... I guess it initiates the need for more information in a lot of cases. So I appreciate this, and I think as we progress, as you mentioned, we'll update this periodically. There's probably other data sets that can be incorporated into this, and we can get a little bit more information as we go. But I appreciate that. Looking at that, along with the one we got from PG&E, both of these create quite an economy for San Luis County. Thank you, Marty.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes, and my questions actually were for the economist. Sorry, Mark. And would it be possible to go back to figure 3, please, the commodities? So my questions, the couple questions I had, these are all figures from 2011.
Yes.
And I know your firm probably has a lot of experience throughout the state now looking at different areas and the commodities they produce and whatnot. So my very first question was, the fourth item down is support activities for ag and forestry, which to my knowledge we have very little forestry, if any, here in the county. But support activities for agriculture would be an example. Support activities.
Productivity, you mean millions of dollars per worker? Or
well, I'm just seeing on your chart where it says support activities for agriculture. And just wondering,
okay,
what examples, because we're talking about activities, it
correctly. Over time, the job of farmers have shifted, and now they outsource lots of technical issues related to irrigation or pest controls.
So we're talking about our petiole reporting and our water, our soil sampling and all those kinds of things.
Right.
Like that.
And well, there's an item on repairs and maintenance that it would go there. This is sometimes scientific work or highly specialized technical work related to certain equipment that is not their own, they're renting or things like that.
So we can kind of summarize that line, and that those are additional businesses that agriculture supports in this county, or locally anyway.
Thing is that sometimes those firms are not located in the county, so we are kind of getting in a negative balance of payment with another county where that firm is located, you know, either Monterey or some other place. What is included here is only the part that is located in San Luis Obispo County.
Okay, good. Okay, perfect. Thank you for answering that, clarifying that.
And also have a minor clarification to the supervisor prior. There are some critical manufacturing operations in the county that import pretty much all their inputs, like the beer production, or all their inputs are not produced locally, and also the spices and condiments, more than 90% of the inputs are from outside the region.
Can I follow up?
Absolutely.
Thank you. But that import to our area of the ones you just mentioned, I guess that initiates an economy here once they sell that product.
Yes.
So, okay.
Exactly.
But is that part of this?
No.
Okay.
Because we wanted to focus on what they buy locally just to keep a...
Gotcha.
I don't know if a closed circuit is the best analogy, but it's just to keep it in-house and kind of within the boundaries of the county, how much this cluster, this agriculture and manufacturing use of local production rather than considering all the imports.
Understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We dependent for that, our fifth highest economic agriculture producer specialty item in the county is completely dependent on rainfall and the feed that's provided in the natural landscape. So now we're looking back to the importance of irrigation to stabilize this agricultural economy. And what we'll be discussing for the next couple of weeks, or at least the next week, is how to help our agricultural economy stay intact while reducing our dependency on pumping out of our water basin and providing supplement, whatever it takes to diminish the dependency on the pumped water on the basin. Just wanted to confirm with you here in public that that is true, that these figures in some of these commodities could change overnight and almost become a zero figure as far as value into the county. And I'm specifically using the cattle on a year following a drought year like this.
Sure, there are many external shocks that can alter this map, if you will. For example, when we analyzed other counties that have different concerns, that is not water, they were concerned about a health scare, right? It's like people start freaking out about contaminated lettuce. The Salinas Valley would disappear overnight because people stop buying lettuce and start eating something else with their lunch, and all of a sudden there's no output for Salinas lettuce. And that is a pretty catastrophic event and hopefully won't happen. They're critical inputs and critical perceptions in the public. And we really haven't focused on water issues yet. When we started this project, the charter was much, much less a year or so ago. But we have looked at other potential risks in other counties. And yes, these figures are subject to change without notice.
Yes, and thank you. The information, the report is excellent.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. I will open it to the public. Don't have any requests to speak. Go ahead, Mary. So I'll close it to the public, and as we bring it back to the board, I'd like to express my appreciation for the work done here. I think it's particularly important that this study has looked at the indirect and the induced effects of agriculture. That's something we haven't delved into previously. We've had our farm gate crop report, and that's a great number. And my thoughts are to encourage your office to continue your investigations as time and resources permit into the economic aspects of agriculture in this county, with, in my mind, perhaps a slightly different focus to complement what I look at here as basically a macro view of our macroeconomic view of our agriculture. But the good gentlemen were explaining the nature of induced economic activity, the thought that a producer takes money gained by agricultural activities and spends it to go to the movies assumes profitability in the agricultural activities. And as a small producer myself, I know that particularly at small scale, profitability has been a continuing struggle for a lot of folks with the nature of the inputs to agriculture, the regulatory requirements, and just the general economic. I've often observed a couple of things. One of them is that I know a few families who make the entirety of their household income off the production of their land. They are by far the exception, and I have nothing but the highest regard for their energy and commitment and challenge that they face. As I look at most agricultural entities in this county, they pretty much constitute small businesses. And it's been my thought for a number of years now that as we are to sustain our ag economy here, we need to sustain our mid-sized and small businesses. And one of the thoughts I think we could have is some help with them on the business aspects of agriculture. This is not something that most people go into agriculture focusing on. You know, they go into agriculture because they love working in the dirt, or, you know, herding cattle, which is working in the dirt. And so the opportunities that we might have to support and understand our smaller and mid-sized producers at the microeconomic level, I think would help guarantee that 10, 20 years from now, if we were to revisit this, we would still have the vibrant economy that we have.
Is this a self-described?
It's the challenge. I can go on for a long time. Ms. Neal.
Thank you, Rita Neal, County Council. As you have just observed, technology is not a strength of mine. today, I was asked to put together a presentation regarding the Public Records Act. The issue of Public Records Act comes up for our office and most of the county on a daily basis. I know that each of the board members on a fairly regular basis receive requests for certain public records, and you all have asked me different questions over the months in our office questions, and we always assist in responding to those requests. So we thought today that not only will we help provide some clarification and just information on the Public Records Act request, and hopefully provide information for the public on what the act is and how we respond to it here at the county. I can also tell you that all departments report that there have been an increase in Public Record Act requests over the years, and in talking to my colleagues in other counties, they're also observing increased requests for public records. The issue of public records was in the news recently when the state legislature in a trailer bill had tried to suspend some mandates regarding responsibility for reimbursing counties for complying with the Public Records Act request. That went over like a lead balloon, and the legislature, that was pulled off the table, but it certainly did begin a discussion about Public Records Act, transparency of government. So today, hopefully, I can provide a little bit of education and information. So I just want to go over what the basics of the act are, the general scope of Public Records Act, and then just to let you know how our county and our staff handle the request and make every effort to respond to it. So where can you find the act, and what is the Public Records Act? Well, it can be found in the government code section, starting with 6250. There's a number of sections. It can also be found in the California Constitution. I believe it was in 2003 or 4. There was an amendment to the Constitution which indicated and added that access to public records is a constitutional right. So the purpose of the act is to ensure the public access to information concerning the conduct of the people's business. It's about transparency. And the legislature has told us, as has case law, that the act should be broadly construed so that we can produce as much information to the public as possible, with a caveat. So the caveat is there's some competing interests. The legislation says the legislature, mindful of the right of individuals to privacy, finds and declares that access to information concerning the conduct of the people's business is a fundamental and necessary right of every person in this state. So the language of mindful of the right of individuals to privacy. As a public entity, we hold a lot of private information. We hold medical records of people. We hold mental health records. records of people. We hold personnel records. We hold child welfare records. So a lot of that information is private and isn't subject to disclosure under the Act. And so we are always mindful, if you will, of the competing interests of being transparent, but also protecting and recognizing and respecting that people have rights to privacy. So what are public records? And this is the definition right out of the statute. It is a writing containing information relating to the conduct of the people's business, prepared, owned, used, or retained by the state or local agency, regardless of the physical form. So I just want to go over a couple of those items. When we talk about prepared, owned, used, or retained by a state or local agency, the law is really developing in this area, and it's developing because of technology advancements. Everybody has a cell phone. Everybody has an iPad. A lot of people have their own personal computers at home. And so when you aren't using a resource that's owned by the public agency, the question is, what's on your private device, is that a public record? And so the question really has come down to, for the courts, is if you're doing the public's business on a private device, then generally it's going to be a public record. So, but again, it's really a balancing because we all have a right to privacy to our private devices as well. The county used to, you know, buy cell phones for employees and issue them, and then we found we had a lot of employees walking around with two cell phones. They would have one cell phone, which was their county cell phone, and one cell phone, which was their private cell phone. That became really kind of difficult to manage. So now we give a stipend to certain employees for their county phones, but then that raises the question, they're doing both private work on their phone, and it's their own phone, and they're doing this a matter of doing a search for the emails. When does a record relate to the conduct of the people's business? So not every document is a public record. The document has to relate to the discharge of the official's duties, memorialize a transaction of the public's business, or in some way be related to the work of the public entity or official. So purely personal information unrelated to the people's business is not considered a public record. What is that? Very few things, quite frankly. Little examples, we might have two employees who are married in different departments and they email each other throughout the day their grocery list or who's picking up the children after work. Not a public record. Sending somebody a happy birthday greeting is probably not a public record, even though it's within a county device. However, the majority of records are public records. So the question really becomes, is it exempt from disclosure? So we ask the question, is it a public record? Majority of the time the answer is yes, with few exceptions. Then really the question becomes, is it exempt? And in a couple minutes I'll talk about exemptions. Who can make a public records request? Any person can make the request. Residents of the county, non-residents, foreign residents, public officials, the media, litigators. It's always interesting to get Public Records Act requests from people who are litigating with the county because there's a whole statutory scheme for discovery within litigation. The Public Records Act request sort of adds an additional avenue sometimes for litigators to get documents that they could also get through the discovery process. There is no particular required format to make a request. It can be verbal or in writing, but it must reasonably describe an identifiable record. We prefer and we usually request that requesters put what they would like in writing. And this really just assists in clarity to make sure that we understand what the request is. Sometimes the requester is looking for a particular document. They don't really know what it's called or what its name is, and we can help them identify that. And you'll know that the legislation requires that we discuss with the requester and assist them to identify what it is they're looking for. And actually, this is kind of a wise section to add into the Act because it does help staff and it helps requesters understand what they're looking for. Sometimes when we talk to them, we're able to really narrow for them what it is they're looking for. And I'll give you an example. A few years ago, we had a public records request for all public records requests. and the requester for one full year. And I went back to the requester and I said, is this really what you're looking for? Because if we just take your very broad request, we will have all the written requests we have, we will have all of our responses, and all of the documents that were produced during that one-year period of time. That was going to constitute thousands upon thousands of documents. The requester indicated, really what I'm looking for is the types of requests you get. I'd like to see first all the requests. And if there's something of interest, maybe I'd like to see how the county responded and what documents they provided. So we worked with the requester to really narrow that down, and the process worked well. I think in talking to the requester, he was satisfied with the way it was handled and got the documentation he wanted, and we were able really to help him and streamline the process. So there are parameters, though, of the Public Records Act request. The public records must exist. We aren't required to create documents for the public. Again, they must be identifiable. And it's also important to understand that the purpose of the request is irrelevant. We don't need to ask why someone is making a request. It's also important that it has to be a request for documents. We don't have to answer interrogatories or information. And again, this is an important distinction when you talk about litigation, because within litigation, they have a whole process by which depositions are taken and interrogatories are responded to. And so we don't have to do that added extra work in responding to Public Records Act requests. And again, we aren't required to create documents. In a few moments, I'll talk about compiling information, but generally we don't have to create documents. We have usually 10 days to respond, sometimes depending upon the type of request, or if we have to work with multiple departments, we can take up to an additional 14 days. We don't have to provide the documents within 10 days, but I would say 99% of our responses, we do provide the documents within 10 days. What we have to respond within 10 days is tell the requester there are either no documents or that there are, release a batch of documents to the requester and try to keep them updated as we're releasing those documents. However, a requester doesn't have to take copies of a document. They can come in during business hours and inspect the records. Staff is often required to sit with the requester if that's what they choose, so that we can protect the records from either theft or accidental damage. Also, a lot of times a requester will then pick out a few pages and say they want copies, and we can do that. However, the case law has been clear that the inspection can't interfere with the orderly function of the agency. So we usually ask people to make appointments so that we can have staff available to bring out the documents and sit with a person who wants to look at those documents. Fees. The only thing we really can charge with regard to responding to Public Records Act is for copies. So our fee schedule has a $10 per page copy fee. 10 cents. Trying to make a little revenue here.
Change the fee ordinance.
We don't get to charge for the staff time to retrieve, review, redact. And I mentioned a little bit ago that we don't have to create documents, but we can charge a fee for actual staff time if producing the records is going to require data compilation or extraction or programming. And I'll give you an example of this. A few years ago, there's a news media outlet in the Bay Area who began collecting information from all public entities regarding the pay and benefits of all employees. And this public records request went out to every single county and city and special district within the state. We realized that although we had, you know, names and salaries of our employees and benefits, it wasn't all in one location, particularly because each employee chooses different benefits. So we had to have the auditor's office create a program in which we could extract that information to put it into a spreadsheet to be able to produce it to the news media outlet in the Bay Area. Bay Area News Group is the name of the group. So for that first year, we charged them staff time, auditor staff time, to actually extract and compile that information. Now we have a program to do that, so when we get some regular requests like that, we don't charge any longer. But that is the one thing that the Act allows us to charge for, other than copies at 10 cents. Let me talk about exemptions for a minute. With every rule, there's always exceptions, and I have one prop for you. So I brought just part of the volume that has the Public Records Act request in it, and generally Section 6254 of the Government Code lists the exceptions, and the exceptions are pages long. And then along with the exceptions within this volume are summaries of all the cases that have addressed the exceptions. So not only are there express exceptions within the Act, there's also an exception that says if there's a statute or another exception in another area of law, that's also exempt. So then you have to go to a bunch of other books to look those up. But the main ones are within the evidence code, attorney-client privilege, doctor-patient privilege. Then there's a balancing test. It's a catch-all provision that applies where a public interest in non-disclosure clearly outweighs the public interest served by disclosure. This isn't used that often, but there are times when we have maybe certain investigations or internal issues that are in process that it's just not appropriate at that time to disclose the records, and so we will do that balancing test. Again, I will tell you, in talking with other counties and anecdotally, I find that we are very transparent and very liberal in our review of records and what we do disclose. Let me talk about just a couple of common exemptions. Preliminary drafts, notes, and memoranda. These are exempt really because it allows staff to work back and forth on a project, freely give their thoughts and ideas to come up with a final product. Pending litigation matters are also exempt from disclosure. We go into closed session almost every week to talk about pending litigation. The public entity is entitled to keep that information private. Again, personnel information, privileged information such as attorney-client medical information. Interesting, trade secrets and proprietary information is also exempt. This usually we find when we have requests for proposals and somebody asks for all the responses. A lot of times proposers will say either their programming information or their pricing is a trade secret. So sometimes we have to make that distinction and decision. Library circulate 81 requests. A lot of their requests are regarding the Los Osos sewer or other projects that they're working on. The assessor received 8 and the Ag Commissioner received 50 in 2012. Probably the most recent data we have in terms of total number of requests was in 2011, we had anywhere from 1,350 to 1,500 written requests. Now, that does not include verbal requests. A lot of verbal requests are made when people come to a counter. They ask for a document. If staff is available and it's easy enough to retrieve, they retrieve it. Nobody really tracks those. Should give you a little sample. In 2011, Animal Services received between 75 and 80. Environmental Health between 220 to 240. The Sheriff's Office in 2011 received 780 requests, but you'll note 720 of those were for crime or incident reports. So they have a staff person who can handle those really simply. Public Works got 55 requests, General Services 45, and the Clerk Recorder 50 to 60. Clerk Recorder is another department who's very used to dealing with requests, and they handle most of those on their own. The types of requests that come in, they vary. They run the gamut. Employee and salary information, contracts between the county and vendors, those are easy to respond to. Most of those come to your board. We get a request for employee contracts. As I said, crime and incident reports, responses to requests for proposals, data regarding funds spent in certain programs. Last year we got one for all the funds spent on mental health programs, documents relating to planning and building projects. This is a pretty time-consuming one because, as you know, projects tend to be document intensive. And then we get requests for code enforcement actions. Again, this is a sample. Most code enforcement action requests are we don't produce because they are exempt. So I wanted to just provide you with two sample requests that are fairly recent. The first one is copies of all documents relating to all money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and subsidiary agencies that the county has disbursed since January 1, 2008. This request came in the spring, and staff went back to the requester and asked that they narrow this request or see if we could determine if there were really what they were looking for. This particular requester indicated that he did not want to narrow the request. It may not seem on its face, but this request comprises of thousands of documents, and it also comprises of a lot of exempt information, including people's private information, financial information, because they apply for this funding based on income. There are also rules and regulations from HUD, which identify what information is confidential and what isn't. So this particular request has been handled out of planning and building with significant input from our office, and this is another batch case. So the way this has been working is there's a person in planning and building searching all the files, all the emails, all the documents, putting a batch together, sending them to our office. We've got a lawyer in our office spending almost a full day a week working on these, identifying what needs to be redacted, identifying what is exempt, sending it back to the department so that we can send out a batch. To date, as of yesterday, we've sent out 24 batches of documents on this one request. We think we have about 20 more to send out. So it will take several months to finalize this project. Again, we try and diligently work through these, but it is a process. The second request was for copies of certified copies of the oaths of office of the following elected representatives. And I think it asked for the sheriff's oath, the assessor's oath, several, about five elected representatives. That's a very easy request to respond to. Clerk's office has those documents, and we're able to respond. We didn't even need to wait the 10 days. We can respond within a couple of days. So that just gives you the both spectrums. On one end, the very voluminous request that we still work diligently to, and then to a rather simple request. So, as I said, every department is really diligent in its search for records, but there is no consistency, and we're working on this, as to how we track requests. Some departments keep a log, and they track each and every request. Some departments don't, and they don't. They have different divisions. The requests come in differently. Some track all their staff time. Some don't. Some have one person within the department, usually the larger departments, who will coordinate a response department-wide, looking for records, looking for emails. And as I said, most departments have reported an increase. So kind of with all this information that we've had, and I think probably that Public Records Act request for Public Records Act request prompted us to do a little further study on this. So the administrative office has created a charge code, which will allow employees to document the time that they're spending responding to Public Records Act requests. This is really, it's not uncommon for the county to help to best respond in assisting them with their responses. They do work, staff works very hard to assure access to the public records, and our office constantly monitors legislation and case law in order to have the most up-to-date information. That concludes my presentation. If there's questions, we're happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Neal. Are there questions from my colleagues for counsel? Seeing none, I will open it to the public. I do have one request to speak, Ms. Tacker.
Good morning again. I am Julie Tacker from District 2. I live in Los Osos. And I would just say that I celebrate the Public Record Act. I believe that complying with the Act is the cost of doing business for the public, and that's who you work for. The more transparent you are, the less requests you will get. The more you use your websites, and each department has one, the less requests you'll get because the public can access the information easily on their own. I have a lot of experience using the Public Record Act and making requests from multiple departments that you have, and I've had different experiences with each, and ultimately my requests are filled. I find it interesting that while it's easy to put something in writing, a form is not required, but some of your departments ask that a form be filled out, that requests can be made verbally. It can be made with anonymity. You don't have to give your name. The request, you can say, without telling your name, that I'll be back in 10 days and see what you've got, but you don't have to leave your name. And just as the Brown Act, the slip, I don't have to tell you my name when I participate in government. Now, I have been receiving some requests that have been redacted. And personal information, names and emails, addresses, phone numbers, those things have been redacted. Yet when I made a request, a voluminous request, for the email between Mr. Gibson and Mrs. Spiro, it was your county council that announced to the public in this room that I had made the public record request and that it was voluminous. My right to privacy was violated. I have been beat up in the press and by the public for making such a request. I would never have made that request if I hadn't listened to the county council say in over the course of 3 days that she'd gone through 6 years of emails and all the invoices that Mr. Gibson and Mrs. Spiro had submitted to the county over the course of their employ and exonerated them from using any county resources. Something that she mentioned about a married couple working within the county and using the inner email, and that's not a public record. But no, it does violate the county's policy on using public property to communicate with each other.
Thank you, Ms. Tackle. With that and no other request to speak, we'll close public comment and bring it back to the board. I don't know, Ms. Neal, if you had any further information you'd like to convey or whether
colleagues had any. Just a couple items for clarification. The names of requesters are considered public documents if the name exists on a document. So it is true that Ms. Tacker made a voluminous request, and I thought I would report to the board that to date we've turned over 4,700 pages of documents to her. Going through the redactions, we have about 7,500 more pages to do. My staff has spent about 136 hours, and I've spent 60 hours redacting. Also, with regard to the county policy on using county resources, the policy with regard to use of county resources is you can use those county resources for minimal personal information. It's just a reality of what happens. So we try and discourage it, but it certainly does happen. And I gave that as an example, just as something that does happen periodically. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Thank you. On behalf of the board, thank you for the tutorial, and thanks staff for their efforts to understand the magnitude of this. I think we do have a resource allocation question that as we move forward, we want to make sure that we are dedicating appropriate resources to getting this important public function done. With that, this is